she said, and threw the door of the car open. "Can I give you a lift? I have to get back and get dinner ready before my employer comes home." It was in the first moment of returning to Galt's house, of standing alone in the silent, sun-filled room, that she faced the full meaning of what she felt. She looked at the window, at the mountains barring the sky in the east. She thought of Hank Reardon as he sat at his desk now, 2,000 miles away, his face tightened into a retaining wall against agony, as it had been tightened under all his blows of all his years, and she felt a desperate wish to fight his battle, to fight for him, for his past, for that tension of his face and the courage that fed it. As she wanted to fight for the comet that crawled by a last effort across a desert on a crumbling track. She shuddered, closing her eyes, feeling as if she were guilty of double treason, feeling as if she were suspended in space between this valley and the rest of the earth, with no right to either. The feeling vanished when she sat facing Galt across the dinner table. He was watching her, openly and with an untroubled look, as if her presence were normal, and as if the sight of her were all he wished to allow into his consciousness. She leaned back a little, as if complying with the meaning of his glance, and said dryly, efficiently, in deliberate denial, "I've checked your shirts and found one with 2 buttons missing, and another with the left elbow worn through. Do you wish me to mend them?"
"Why, yes, if you can do it."
"I can do it." It did not seem to alter the nature of his glance. It merely seemed to stress its satisfaction, as if this were what he had wished her to say, except that she was not certain whether satisfaction was the name for the thing she saw in his eyes, and fully certain that he had not wished her to say anything. Beyond the window, at the edge of the table, storm clouds had wiped out the last remnants of light in the eastern sky. She wondered why she felt a sudden reluctance to look out, why she felt as if she wanted to cling to the golden patches of light on the wood of the table, on the buttered crust of the rolls, on the copper coffee pot, on Galt's hair. To cling as to a small island on the edge of a void. Then she heard her own voice asking suddenly, involuntarily, and she knew that this was the treason she had wanted to escape. "Do you permit any communication with the outside world?"
"No."
"Not any? Not even a note without return address?"
"No."
"Not even a message? If no secret of yours were given away?"
"Not from here. Not during this month. Not to outsiders at any time."
She noticed that she was avoiding his eyes, and she forced herself to lift her head and face him. His glance had changed. It was watchful, unmoving, implacably perceptive. He asked, looking at her as if he knew the reason of her query,
"Do you wish to ask for a special exception?"
"No," she answered, holding his glance. Next morning after breakfast, when she sat in her room, carefully placing a patch on the sleeve of Galt's shirt, with her door closed, not to let him see her fumbling effort at an unfamiliar task, she heard the sound of a car stopping in front of the house. She heard Galt's steps hurrying across the living room. She heard him jerk the entrance door open and call out with the joyous anger of relief, "It's about time!" She rose to her feet, but stopped. She heard his voice. Its tone abruptly changed and grave, as if in answer to the shock of some sight confronting him. "What's the matter?"
"Hello, John,"
said a clear, quiet voice that sounded steady, but weighted with exhaustion. She sat down on her bed, feeling suddenly drained of strength. The voice was Francisco's. She heard Galt asking, his tone severe with concern, "What is it?"
"I'll tell you afterwards."
"Why are you so late?"
"I have to leave again in an hour."
"To leave?"
"John, I just came to tell you that I won't be able to stay here this year."
There was a pause. Then Galt asked gravely, his voice low,
"Is it as bad as that, whatever it is?"
"Yes, I might be back before the month is over, I don't know." He added with the sound of a desperate effort, "I don't know whether to hope to be done with it quickly or not."
"Francisco, could you stand a shock right now?"
"I? Nothing could shock me now."
"There's a person here in my guest room whom you have to see.
It will be a shock to you, so I think I'd better warn you in advance that this person is still a scab."
"What? A scab?
In your house?"
Let me tell you how. That's something I want to see for myself.
She heard Francisco's contemptuous chuckle and the rush of his steps. She saw her door flung open, and she noticed dimly that it was Galt who closed it, leaving them alone. She did not know how long Francisco stood looking at her, because the first moment that she grasped fully was when she saw him on his knees holding on to her, his face pressed to her legs, the moment when she felt as if the shudder that ran through his body and left him still had run into hers and made her able to move. She saw in astonishment that her hand was moving gently over his hair, while she was thinking that she had no right to do it, and feeling as if a current of serenity were flowing from her hand, enveloping them both, smoothing the past. He did not move. He made no sound, as if the act of holding her said everything he had to say. When he raised his head, he looked as she had felt when she had opened her eyes in the valley. He looked as if no pain had ever existed in the world. He was laughing. Dagny, Dagny, Dagny. His voice sounded not as if a confession resisted for years were breaking out, but as if he were repeating the long since known, laughing at the pretense that it had ever been unsaid. Of course I love you. Were you afraid when he made me say it? I'll say it as often as you wish. I love you, darling. I love you. I always will. Don't be afraid for me. I don't care if I'll never have you again. What does that matter? You're alive, and you're here, and you know everything now. And it's so simple, isn't it? Do you see what it was and why I had to desert you? His arms swept out to point at the valley. There it is. It's your earth, your kingdom, your kind of world. Dagny, I've always loved you. And that I deserted you, that was my love. He took her hands and pressed them to his lips and held them, not moving, not as a kiss, but as a long moment of rest, as if the effort of speech were a distraction from the fact of her presence, and as if he were torn by too many things to say, by the pressure of all the words stored in the silence of years. The women I chased, you didn't believe that, did you? I've never touched one of them, but I think you knew it. I think you've known it all along. The playboy, it was a part that I had to play in order not to let the looters suspect me while I was destroying Donconia Copper in plain sight of the whole world. That's the joker in their system. They're out to fight any man of honor and ambition, but let them see a worthless rotter and they think he's a friend. They think he's safe. Safe! That's their view of life. But are they learning? Are they learning whether evil is safe and incompetence practical? Dagny, it was the night when I knew for the first time that I loved you. It was then that I knew I had to go. It was when you entered my hotel room that night, when I saw what you looked like, what you were, what you meant to me. And what awaited you in the future? Had you been less, you might have stopped me for a while. But it was you, you, who were the final argument that made me leave you. I asked for your help that night, against John Galt. But I knew that you were his best weapon against me, though neither you nor he could know it. You were everything that he was seeking, everything he told us to live for, or die if necessary. I was ready for him when he called me suddenly to come to New York that spring. I had not heard from him for some time. He was fighting the same problem I was. He solved it. Do you remember? It was the time when you did not hear from me for 3 years. Dagny, when I took over my father's business, when I began to deal with the whole industrial system of the world, it was then that I began to see the nature of the evil I'd suspected but thought too monstrous to believe. I saw the tax-collecting vermin that had grown for centuries like mildew on Donconia Copper, draining us by no right that anyone could name. I saw the government regulations passed to cripple me because I was successful, and to help my competitors because they were loafing failures. I saw the labor unions who won every claim against me by reason of my ability to make their livelihood possible. I saw that any man's desire for money he could not earn was regarded as a righteous wish. But if he earned it, it was damned as greed. I saw the politicians who winked at me, telling me not to worry because I could just work a little harder and outsmart them all. I looked past the profits of the moment, and I saw that the harder I worked, the more I tightened the noose around my throat. I saw that my energy was being poured down a sewer, that the parasites who fed on me were being fed upon in their turn, that they were caught in their own trap, and that there was no reason for it, no answer known to anyone, that the sewer pipes of the world, draining its productive blood, led into some dank fog nobody had dared to pierce, while people merely shrugged and said that life on Earth could be nothing but evil. And then I saw that the whole industrial establishment of the world, with all of its magnificent machinery, its thousand-ton furnaces, its transatlantic cables, its mahogany offices, its stock exchanges, its blazing electric signs, its power, its wealth,
All of it was run, not by bankers and boards of directors, but by any unshaved humanitarian in any basement beer joint, by any face pudgy with malice who preached that virtue must be penalized for being virtue, that the purpose of ability is to serve incompetence, that man has no right to exist except for the sake of others. I knew it. I saw no way to fight it. John found the way. There were just the two of us with him, the night when we came to New York in answer to his call, Ranyar and I. He told us what we had to do and what sort of men we had to reach. He had quit the 20th century. He was living in a garret in a slum neighborhood. He stepped to the window and pointed at the skyscrapers of the city. He said that we had to extinguish the lights of the world, and when we would see the lights of New York go out, we would know that our job was done. He did not ask us to join him at once. He told us to think it over and to weigh everything it would do to our lives. I gave him my answer on the morning of the second day, and Ranyar a few hours later in the afternoon. Dagny, that was the morning after our last night together. I had seen, in a manner of vision that I couldn't escape, what it was that I had to fight for. It was for the way you looked that night, for the way you talked about your railroad, for the way you had looked when we tried to see the skyline of New York from the top of a rock over the Hudson. I had to save you, to clear the way for you, to let you find your city, not to let you stumble the years of your life away, struggling on through a poisoned fog, with your eyes still held straight ahead, still looking as they had looked in the sunlight, struggling on to find at the end of your road not the towers of a city, but a fat, soggy, mindless cripple performing his enjoyment of life by means of swallowing the gin your life had gone to pay for. You, to know no joy in order that he may know it. You, to serve as fodder for the pleasure of others. You, as the means for the subhuman as the end. Dagny, that was what I saw, and that was what I couldn't let them do to you. Not to you, not to any child who had your kind of look when he faced the future. Not to any man who had your spirit and was able to experience a moment of being proudly, guiltlessly, confidently, joyously alive. That was my love, that state of the human spirit, and I left you to fight for it. And I knew that if I were to lose you, it was still you that I would be winning with every year of the battle. But you see it now, don't you? You've seen this valley. It's the place we set out to reach when we were children, you and I. We've reached it. What else can I ask for now, just to see you here? Did John say you're still a scab? Oh, well, it's only a matter of time. But you'll be one of us, because you've always been. If you don't see it fully, we'll wait. I don't care, so long as you're alive, so long as I don't have to go on flying over the Rockies looking for the wreckage of your plane. She gasped a little, realizing why he had not come to the valley on time. He laughed. Don't look like that. Don't look at me as if I were a wound that you're afraid to touch. Francisco, I've hurt you in so many ways. No, no, you haven't hurt me. And he hasn't either. Don't say anything about it. It's he who's hurt. But we'll save him. And he'll come here too, where he belongs, and he'll know. And then he too will be able to laugh about it. Dagny, I didn't expect you to wait. I didn't hope. I knew the chance I'd taken, and if it had to be anyone, I'm glad it's he. She closed her eyes, pressing her lips together, not to moan. Darling, don't you see that I've accepted it? But it isn't, she thought. It isn't he, and I can't tell you the truth because it's a man who might never hear it from me, and whom I might never have. Francisco, I did love you, she said, and caught her breath, shocked, realizing that she had not intended to say it, and simultaneously that this was not the tense she had wanted to use. But you do, he said calmly, smiling. You still love me, even if there's one expression of it that you'll always feel and want, but will not give me any longer. I'm still what I was, and you'll always see it, and you'll always grant me the same response, even if there's a greater one that you grant to another man. No matter what you feel for him, it will not change what you feel for me, and it won't be treason to either, because it comes from the same root. It's the same payment in answer to the same values. No matter what happens in the future, we'll always be what we were to each other, you and I, because you'll always love me. Francisco, she whispered, do you know that? Of course. Don't you understand it now? Dagny, every form of happiness is one. Every desire is driven by the same motor, by our love for a single value, for the highest potentiality of our own existence, and every achievement is an expression of it. Look around you. Do you see how much is open to us here on an unobstructed earth? Do you see how much I am free to do, to experience, to achieve? Do you see that all of it is part of what you are to me, as I am part of it for you? And if I'll see you smile with admiration at a new copper smelter that I built, it will be another form of what I felt when I lay in bed beside you. Will I want to sleep with you? Desperately. Will I envy the man who does? Sure. But what does that matter? It's so much just to have you here, to love you, and to be alive. Her eyes lowered, her face stern, holding her head bowed as in an act of reverence. She said slowly, as if fulfilling a solemn promise, "Will you forgive me?" He looked astonished, then chuckled gaily, remembering, and answered, "Not yet. There's nothing to forgive, but I'll forgive it when you join us." He rose, he drew her to her feet, and when his arms closed about her, their kiss was the summation of their past, its end, and their seal of acceptance. Galt turned to them from across the living room when they came out. He had been standing at a window looking at the valley, and she felt certain that he had stood there all that time. She saw his eyes studying their faces, his glance moving slowly from one to the other. His face relaxed a little at the sight of the change in Francisco's. Francisco smiled, asking him, "Why do you stare at me? Do you know what you looked like when you came in?" "Oh, did I? That's because I hadn't slept for 3 nights. John, will you invite me to dinner? I want to know how this scab of yours got here, but I think that I might collapse sound asleep in the middle of a sentence, even though right now I feel as if I'll never need any sleep at all. So I think I'd better go home and stay there till evening." Galt was watching him with a faint smile. "But aren't you going to leave the valley in an hour?" "What? No," he said mildly, in momentary astonishment. "No," he laughed exultantly. "I don't have to." "That's right, I haven't told you what it was, have I? I was searching for Dagny, for the wreck of a plane. She'd been reported lost in a crash in the Rockies." "I see," said Galt quietly. "I could have thought of anything except that she would choose to crash in Galt's Gulch," Francisco said happily. He had the tone of that joyous relief which almost relishes the horror of the past, defying it by means of the present. "I kept flying over the district between Afton, Utah, and Winston, Colorado, over every peak and crevice of it, over every remnant of a car in any gully below, and whenever I saw one, I—" He stopped. It looked like a shudder. "Then at night we went out on foot, the searching parties of railroad men from Winston. We went climbing at random, with no clues, no plan, on and on until it was daylight again. And—" He shrugged, trying to dismiss it and to smile. "I wouldn't wish it on my worst." He stopped short. His smile vanished, and a dim reflection of the look he had worn for 3 days came back to his face, as if at the sudden presence of an image he had forgotten. After a long moment, he turned to Galt. "John," his voice sounded peculiarly solemn, "could we notify those outside that Dagny is alive, in case there's somebody who'd feel as I did?" Galt was looking straight at him. "Do you wish to give any outsider any relief from the consequences of remaining outside?" Francisco dropped his eyes, but answered firmly, "No." "Pity, Francisco?" "Yes, forget it. You're right." Galt turned away with a movement that seemed oddly out of character. It had the unrhythmical abruptness of the involuntary. He did not turn back. Francisco watched him in astonishment, then asked softly, "What's the matter?" Galt turned and looked at him for a moment, not answering. She could not identify the emotion that softened the lines of Galt's face. It had the quality of a smile, of gentleness, of pain, and of something greater that seemed to make these concepts superfluous. "Whatever any of us is paid for this battle," said Galt. You're the one who's taken the hardest beating, aren't you? Who, I? Francisco grinned with shocked, incredulous amusement. Certainly not. What's the matter with you? He chuckled and added, Pity, John? No, said Galt firmly. She saw Francisco watching him with a faint, puzzled frown, because Galt had said it, looking not at him, but at her. The emotional sum that struck her as an immediate impression of Francisco's house when she entered it for the first time was not the sum she had once drawn from the sight of its silent, locked exterior. She felt not a sense of tragic loneliness, but of invigorating brightness. The rooms were bare and crudely simple. The house seemed built with the skill, the decisiveness, and the impatience typical of Francisco. It looked like a frontiersman's shanty thrown together to serve as a mere springboard for a long flight into the future. A future where so great a field of activity lay waiting that no time could be wasted on the comfort of its start. The place had the brightness not of a home, but of a fresh wooden scaffolding erected to shelter the birth of a skyscraper. Francisco, in shirt sleeves, stood in the middle of his 12-foot square living room, with the look of a host in a palace. Of all the places where she had ever seen him, this was the background that seemed most properly his, just as the simplicity of his clothes, added to his bearing, gave him the air of a superlative aristocrat. So the crudeness of the room gave it the appearance of the most patrician retreat. A single royal touch was added to the crudeness. Two ancient silver goblets stood in a small niche cut in a wall of bare logs. Their ornate design had required the luxury of some craftsman's long and costly labor, more labor than had gone to build the shanty, a design dimmed by the polish of more centuries than had gone to grow the log wall's pines. In the midst of that room, Francisco's easy, natural manner had a touch of quiet pride, as if his smile were silently saying to her, This is what I am and what I have been all these years. She looked up at the silver goblets. Yes, he said in answer to her silent guess. They belong to Sebastian Dunconia and his wife. That's the only thing I brought here from my palace in Buenos Aires. That and the crest over the door. It's all I wanted to save. Everything else will go in a very few months now. He chuckled. They'll seize it, all of it. The last dregs of Dunconia copper, but they'll be surprised. They won't find much for their trouble. And as to that palace, they won't be able to afford even its heating bill. And then, she asked, Where will you go from there? I will go to work for Dunconia Copper. What do you mean? Do you remember that old slogan, The king is dead, long live the king? When the carcass of my ancestors' property is out of the way, then my mine will become the young new body of Dunconia Copper, the kind of property my ancestors had wanted, had worked for, had deserved, but had never owned. Your mine? What mine? Where? Here, he said, pointing toward the mountain peaks. Didn't you know it? No. I own a copper mine that the looters won't reach. It's here in these mountains. I did the prospecting. I discovered it. I broke the first excavation. It was over 8 years ago. I was the first man to whom Midas sold land in this valley. I bought that mine. I started it with my own hands, as Sebastian Dunconia had started. I have a superintendent in charge of it now who used to be my best metallurgist in Chile. The mine produces all the copper we require. My profits are deposited at the Mulligan Bank. That will be all I'll have a few months from now. That will be all I'll need. To conquer the world, was the way his voice sounded on his last sentence. And she marveled at the difference between that sound and the shameful, mawkish tone, half whine, half threat, the tone of beggar and thug combined which the men of their century had given to the word need. Dagny, he was saying, standing at the window, as if looking out at the peaks, not of mountains, but of time. The rebirth of Dunconia Copper and of the world has to start here, in the United States. This country was the only country in history born not of chance and blind tribal warfare, but as a rational product of man's mind. This country was built on the supremacy of reason, and for one magnificent century it redeemed the world. It will have to do so again. The first step of Dunconia Copper, as of any other human value, has to come from here, because the rest of the earth has reached the consummation of the beliefs it has held through the ages. Mystic faith, the supremacy of the irrational, which has but two monuments at the end of its course, the lunatic asylum in the graveyard. Sebastian Danconia committed one error. He accepted a system which declared that the property he had earned by right was to be his not by right, but by permission. His descendants paid for that error. I've made the last payment. I think that I will see the day when, growing out from their root in this soil, the mines, the smelters, the ore docks of Danconia Copper will spread again through the world and down to my native country, and I will be the first to start my country's rebuilding. I may see it, but I cannot be certain. No man can predict the time when others will choose to return to reason. It may be that at the end of my life I shall have established nothing but this single mine, Danconia Copper No. 1, Galt's Gulch, Colorado, USA. But, Dagny, do you remember that my ambition was to double my father's production of copper? Dagny, if at the end of my life I produce but 1 pound of copper a year, I will be richer than my father, richer than all my ancestors with all their thousands of tons, because that 1 pound will be mine by right and will be used to maintain a world that knows it. This was the Francisco of their childhood, in bearing and manner, in the unclouded brilliance in his eyes, and she found herself questioning him about his copper mine, as she had questioned him about his industrial projects on their walks on the shore of the Hudson, recapturing the sense of an unobstructed future. "I'll take you to see the mine," he said, "as soon as your ankle recovers completely. We have to climb a steep trail to get there, just a mule trail. There's no truck road as yet. Let me show you the new smelter I'm designing. I've been working on it for some time. It's too complex for our present volume of production, but when the mine's output grows to justify it, just take a look at the time, labor, and money that it will save." They were sitting together on the floor, bending over the sheets of paper he spread before her, studying the intricate sections of the smelter, with the same joyous earnestness they had once brought to the study of scraps in a junkyard. She leaned forward just as he moved to reach for another sheet, and she found herself leaning against his shoulder. Involuntarily, she held still for one instant, no longer than for a small break in the flow of a single motion, while her eyes rose to his. He was looking down at her, neither hiding what he felt nor implying any further demand. She drew back, knowing that she had felt the same desire as his. Then, still holding the recaptured sensation of what she had felt for him in the past, she grasped a quality that had always been part of it, now suddenly clear to her for the first time. If that desire was a celebration of one's life, then what she had felt for Francisco had always been a celebration of her future, like a moment of splendor gained in part payment of an unknown total, affirming some promise to come. In the instant when she grasped it, she knew also the only desire she had ever experienced, not in token of the future, but of the full and final present. She knew it by means of an image. The image of a man's figure standing at the door of a small granite structure. The final form of the promise that had kept her moving, she thought, was the man who would perhaps remain a promise never to be reached. But this, she thought in consternation, was that view of human destiny which she had most passionately hated and rejected, the view that man was ever to be drawn by some vision of the unattainable shining ahead, doomed ever to aspire, but not to achieve. Her life and her values could not bring her to that, she thought. She had never found beauty in longing for the impossible, and had never found the possible to be beyond her reach. But she had come to it, and she could find no answer. She could not give him up, or give up the world, she thought, looking at Galt that evening. The answer seemed harder to find in his presence. She felt that no problem existed, that nothing could stand beside the fact of seeing him, and nothing would ever have the power to make her leave, and simultaneously, that she would have no right to look at him if she were to renounce her railroad. She felt that she owned him, that the unnamed had been understood between them from the start, and simultaneously, that he was able to vanish from her life and on some future street of the outside world to pass her by in unweighted indifference. She noted that he did not question her about Francisco. When she spoke of her visit, she could find no reaction in his face, neither of approval nor of resentment. It seemed to her that she caught an imperceptible shading in his gravely attentive expression. He looked as if this were a matter about which he did not choose to feel. Her faint apprehension grew into a question mark, and the question mark turned into a drill, cutting deeper and deeper into her mind through the evenings that followed, when Galt left the house and she remained alone. He went out every other night after dinner, not telling her where he went, returning at midnight or later. She tried not to allow herself fully to discover with what tension and restlessness she waited for his return. She did not ask him where he spent his evenings. The reluctant